I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania has an education funding formula, something it didn't have for many years, making it an outlier compared to most other states. Now, Pennsylvania will use criteria like poverty and household income, the number of English language learners, the number of charter schools in a district, even something called sparsity size adjustment in determining how to deploy education dollars. There is a caveat, though. This is only for new money earmarked for education spending, $152 million for this fiscal year, and that's a tiny percent of the basic education subsidy. This is big news, though, and here to walk us through the formula and some of the politics involved is Kevin McCrory, state education reporter for WHYY's Keystone Crossroads. And Kevin, always nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So glad to be here, Marty.
And I should say to our listeners, we posted on our Facebook page some links to some of the reporting that you have been doing for Keystone Crossroads. So what did it take to get to this education formula? It's been many years without an education formula. What was driving it?
There was a lot of advocacy behind this idea that we did not have this student-weighted, rational way of dividing money. That's what a formula is all about. Whatever amount of money you have, how do you divide it? Who should get the most? Who deserves the most? Who needs the most? That wasn't really a systematic question that the state had been answering, and it had been essentially saying, we're going to guarantee that you get the same amount that you got last year, plus, you know, maybe a cost of living increase, an indexed inflationary increase. And over time, you saw that develop huge inequities, especially between districts that either gained or lost a lot of it, right, enrollment, a lot of population.
And kids move around, families move around, people move in and out of districts. There's a lot of churn in the system, I would think.
Absolutely, a lot of churn. And the districts that have been kind of historically hurt the most were ones that not only gained population and gained enrollment, but within that population was additional poverty, deeper poverty, kids that were not fluent in English as a first language. And so when you add all that up and you have a state not acknowledging poverty, not acknowledging language fluency, not acknowledging just actual enrollment, it ended up in this system where you couldn't really see the rationality in how the state was dividing its main pot of education cash.
And I do want to talk about how this formula works, but just to put a bit of a reality check, we're not talking about billions of dollars here being moved around, as you indicated, $152 million to pay for this fiscal year.
Right. So that's out of this whole, you know, historically long budget impasse that we had, where at the end of the day, the budget was passed 9 months late, and here was this $152 million that was the new education money going through this formula. There was another $50 million that the governor allocated on his own. But yes, that $150 million is under 3% of the total. So
right,
the state's basic education pot, the main pot of cash, is like $5.6 billion. So 5 point whatever minus $152 million is still distributed in that old way. So all that inequity is kind of baked in the cake, if you will. And you're only going to make things fair, quote unquote, according to the formula, as you keep increasing the amount of money you put through there. Now, to make it so that half of all the money is through the formula, it would take putting another $5.6 billion which could take a lot of years, right? I mean, that could take 25
a generation
years.
Maybe.
Oh, absolutely. So if you put in $200 million new dollars a year every year for that long, it's going to be like today's kindergartners are 30 years old before that happens.
Well, some of the factors are things like enrollment, and it is interesting that enrollment is now part of the formula. Poverty, numbers, and several ways to calculate poverty. English language learners, that's also a factor. So all these things were weighted and used to figure out a formula of distribution.
Absolutely. So it was a commission that was called for under former Governor Corbett, and the Senate and the House came together. It was Pat Brown, who was a state senator from the Allentown area, and Mike Verb, who is a representative from Montgomery County. They were the leads in the House and Senate, and they put together this commission and kind of wrestled with these questions, took testimony from all over the state, talked to teachers, talked to parents, talked to advocates, and wrestled back and forth. How much should we consider this? What should we consider? And at the end of the day, they were able to come up with a bipartisan formula, which is kind of a miracle sometimes in Harrisburg.
Yes,
they all agreed on it. One of the things that made it much more palatable and probably possible to happen was that they specifically were not asking what some see as a crucial question, which is how much does it actually cost to make sure that all the students in this state have the resources, have the things around them that they need to ensure that they're performing at the state's expectations. So basically hitting the standards on the state tests.
They did not
ask that question. So you know, you could ask, well, how much does it cost?
Well, I was just going to say, does anyone know how much that would cost?
The last time that was studied in Pennsylvania was in 2006, and that's what the Rendell administration had been hoping to. I can't remember the exact figure, but it's in the billions of an increase at that point. And so they had been aiming then to increase funding to the levels that would get to that adequacy target. So, but when you put an adequacy target out there, that's a big figure. So that's why this commission said, we're not going to look at that question. We're just going to say, of whatever money we do have, how do we divide it?
You compared two districts, two very different school districts, one in Reading, Pennsylvania, Reading, obviously we're talking about Pennsylvania, the other New Hope, Solbury, which is, I guess, comparing what a poor district with a more well-heeled district.
Sure, sure. And so what's interesting to see there is, okay, you know, Reading has a ballpark, 20,000 kids or something like that. And then what the formula does is it says, or how many kids are in poverty? How many are in acute poverty? How many are in concentrated poverty?
And those are the poverty criteria.
Right. How many are English language learners? How many kids are in charter schools? Like you said, all these factors. And then you multiply these weights by the actual enrollment, and all of a sudden it's as if Reading has to serve four times its actual population. And you take that final number compared with the state's total number, and then you just divide. So Reading gets the percentage of the total. And in New Hope, Solbury, it's kind of the opposite because they don't have the poverty levels at all, right? To a large degree, they don't have as many charter students, if at all. They don't have as many English language learners, and so there, it's the formula makes it as if they have less students than they actually have.
Oh, interesting! And then figuring the formula
You figure out from there, and so you know, New Hope Solbury gets a much smaller fraction of the new money than Reading was. And that's probably how you should expect it, right? Because the entire idea of state funding, just at a basic level, is to say, how can we better redistribute and make fair a system that relies so much on local property taxes, right? So if you have local wealth, you don't really need state aid in one, you know.
One of the things that you looked at is how much money actually then would be distributed or sent to, let's say, a poor district like one in Reading. And it's something like $372 per student. So it's not as – I mean, you can multiply that times the number of students.
Right.
Would it be fair to say there are winners and losers under this formula?
Yeah. You know, I think that the winners are the districts that have been historically given funding inequitably. So now that you're actually counting enrollment and you're acknowledging the fact that when you have students that carry a lot of challenges with them, that's a huge burden and it takes more money and it costs more for districts to be able to serve those students. Now that you're acknowledging all that, then absolutely. You're seeing the Eries, the Philadelphias, the Reddings, the Yorks, Allentowns, Shenandoah Valley, Panther Valley, these historically distressed districts across the state are being favored in this district, but it gets back in this formula, but it gets back to this question of, well, still the total money that the state's spending is really still not favoring those districts as much as it should. And just to put it in, you know, the simplest terms, Reading is probably, if not the most distressed school district in the state. And when you look at the fact that they've grown tremendously in population, that population has become much more impoverished, and they have a lot of English language learners, right? So they have they hit the marks on this formula completely. If you just look at the total of the money that the state spends per pupil, they are 45th on the list. And above them, 40 of the 44 other school districts, some of them are wealthier districts. Some of them are in the top fifth of median household income in the state. And you say, well, how is that even possible? Well, it's just because when you're not counting actual enrollment for 25 years, if your district loses a lot of kids and the state keeps sending you the same amount of money, then all of a sudden your per pupil rate goes up. It really doesn't make any rational sense.
It doesn't.
But that's what's been happening for 25
years.
I
mean, enrollment is so basic to education because that's obviously how we fund those dollars. What's this thing called sparsity size adjustment? I'm going to have you explain that, Kevin.
Sure. So I mean, that's just a recognition that when you have a very geographically large district, there are economies of scale that you're missing that are very hard to accomplish when you have to bus kids all over the place. When you have a school here 100 miles away from the other school in your district. And just the reality when you have that large of a district but not that many kids, there's just a strain to the system. And I think that was something that the rural districts, the small districts in the state fought to make sure that they were being recognized too at the table, and it wasn't just kind of the things that you would typically think of in distressed urban districts.
Things like what, computers or special advanced placement classes, things like that?
Right. So, I mean, you think about the amount of kids. If you're in a small rural district and your resources are spread a little thinner, right, maybe you want to have an AP bio class. Maybe you don't have the kids that would necessitate spending the money to spend on that teacher. So it's just harder to do for those districts in that case. Yeah.
And what about charter schools? That's certainly a big issue in Philadelphia, but other districts as well.
Right. So there continues to be this debate outside of any formula conversations about like what are the stranded costs of charter schools? Like basically, charter schools are their own entities. They have their own administrations. They have their own systems. And when you have, in Philadelphia, we have 80-some charter schools. So we have 80-some systems plus the school district, and there's redundancies there. And that when students move from one to the other, it's not like the systems can automatically, reflex and downsize their spending at the same speed. So there's these stranded costs that are incurred, at the district level that are really lost to the children in the system. It's not like the district all of a sudden can spend that money on the kids. It's just systemic costs. And there's this debate about what that level is. And in this formula, they put a 0.2 weight on it to say that we recognize that there are these costs and we're going to favor districts that have a lot of charter students to help them make up for that.
We're almost having a break here, and Donna Cooper will be joining us after the break. The governor of the legislature is still figuring out the budget for the next fiscal year,
right,
assuming that they can pass something on time by the end of the week. There will be new money to be spent then in the next fiscal year?
I would bet on the fact that there would be new money. It's always a question of how much that will be. The governor had been seeking $350 million as an increase for the basic education subsidy. He recently revised that down to $250 million. I think in his mind, a compromise and an olive branch trying to reach out and make sure that there is a more timely budget this year. So we'll see if that's palatable with the Republican-controlled legislature. And, of course, there's a million other little factors that they're all negotiating around right now. So we'll see where it all ends.
We'll see. Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Kevin McCory, state education reporter for WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, talking about an education funding formula that was passed just recently. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Kevin McCory, state education reporter for WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, talking about this new education funding formula passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. And joining us now is Donna Cooper. She's head of Public Citizens for Children and Youth. And we want to know what she thinks of this education formula and whether it addresses some of the funding disparities or inequities in the state. And Donna, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to talk with you guys.
You have described this as a quiet revolution. I think this was a month or two ago. We've been talking with Kevin about how the formula will work. How do you see it?
Well, I think it depends on how the legislature decides and the people of the Commonwealth decide the formula should be applied. Kevin did an outstanding job explaining that the formula compensates for the disparity in local wealth in a state that depends so much on property taxes to fund the schools. And the goal of it is to try and make sure that children in every county and every community have access to a quality education and can meet the graduate, you know, ready for college or their jobs. And one of the challenges is right now that we are applying the formula, or there's a desire in the legislature to apply the formula to new money. So let's say the budget passes this week and right. the House passed the budget last night with $200 million more dollars for schools, which is wonderful. But you sort of think about that against the nearly $6 billion that's already out there. And as Kevin explained, that $6 billion that's out there hasn't been adjusted for enrollment in 25 years. So the $200 million now will go out based on real numbers and real enrollment and advantage those school districts that have the heaviest burden of educating children with the greatest needs. But it's a sliver of what needs to be done to really ensure a school district like Reading or William Penn or Southeast Elko or Bristol or Philly can really deliver the quality of education that's needed for kids who come to school with such deficits. And we know that we're depending on them to be the next generation to run our state, but we're not yet at a place where we can tilt the scales in their favor.
Kevin, just a basic question here.
Sure.
So let's say it is $200 million for the next fiscal year. Does that get added to the $150 that was – I mean, is it slowly, incrementally
yeah.
increased? Is it added to the $150 that was earmarked for this year?
Yeah. So, I mean, the way to think about it is this past year, 97% of the money in the pot is still distributed based on basic this lack of a formula. And then as you keep adding money, so if it's $200 million this year, that percentage will slowly go down over the years. Just to put some real numbers on it, too,
sure.
while we're at it, you know, no one is politically calling for this because it's just impossible and would be devastating. But if you just took all the money and put it through the formula, Philadelphia would get $355 million more every year. And I mean,
because of the needs of the children.
Yeah. Well, based on what the formula says the need is. Now, that formula will change every year as the demographics change. But based on what it is right now, $355 million. You can imagine what that could have meant over the past number of years where we've seen devastating cuts, where we've seen, you know, very difficult choices being made constantly. Up in Erie, they're talking about closing all of their high schools and sending their kids to outlying county districts. They have a $4 million budget shortfall, you know, much smaller budget shortfall numbers than we hear about in Philadelphia, but they have, you know, far fewer students. If all the money went through the formula, they would have $38 million more every year. They're not talking about closing high schools in Erie if this had been addressed years ago. Now, again, it's just not politically possible because what that is going to do is suck money out of 350 districts and put it in 150 districts. So just do the math politically. That's not
sure.
going to happen.
Sure.
And it just so happens that most of the powerful top legislative leaders in the state represent districts where enrollment has declined steeply and their districts have greatly benefited from that fact.
Let me go back to you, Don. You might want to add to that, but also the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is considering or, I guess, involved in a lawsuit dealing with some of this education funding. What's the status of that?
So the court will hear the case in September, and I think based on the budget that is likely to pass this week, I think it makes a very crystal clear case for why the courts need to intervene because, as Kevin points out, legislative leaders have declining enrollment in their districts, so they don't need to advocate for any change. Their school districts are de facto getting more money per student with no change. And so it seems, given that inertia, the only thing that's going to sort of tip the scales here is a state lawsuit where the courts require the legislature and the governor to come up with a cure for this status quo that is putting the growing and poorer districts at significant disadvantage at peril to the Commonwealth, not just those children, but to the Commonwealth. So I think this court case is very, very important. The plaintiffs have made an extraordinary case about the injury to the school districts, particularly as a result of the cuts that happened in 2011. Just to put it in perspective, Kevin said if all the money was put through the formula, the Philadelphia School District would get about $355 million more, $360. It lost nearly $300 million when the 2011 cuts were put into effect by Governor Cormitt. So, you know, we were making some progress in tilting the resources towards these districts up until the Corbett administration, and that devastating nearly billion-dollar cut has really caused this quiet revolution around the school funding formula. So now we have a formula, but what the courts will observe is that that formula, as Kevin points out, is affecting less than 3% of the money that is being distributed. And so, you know, I think the opportunity for the courts to rectify the situation will be great. The resistance in the legislature to them doing so, as Kevin points out, is going to be very significant. What it will mean is, instead of taking money away from Crawford County or Warren County, it will likely mean that the solution to this is going to mean that we need to have new revenues on the table so that we can distribute more of the formula through new revenues. Because even in Warren and Crawford County, where their numbers are going up because the amount of state aid is going up per student because they have fewer kids, they're still poor districts. You know, they're poor rural districts. It's not like they're floating in dough. So, you know, taking money from them is going to injure the quality of education for those kids. And we still have, you know, ways to go in Pennsylvania for a high quality education for every kid. So hopefully a court decision and more focus, as Kevin has put on this, about declining enrollment in districts that have and the legislators who represent them being the biggest resistors to any new revenues will cause a new coalition to form that really drives for the resources needed for the Reddings and the Norristowns, et cetera.
I mean, Donna, you talk about new revenue, and I mean, we sort of stumbled through this fiscal year in Pennsylvania in terms of trying to come up with a budget. Is that really realistic to say that there's money that can be found to be spent on education?
Well, there's certainly. You know, we have one of the lowest personal income tax rates in the country of the states that have a personal income tax. So Pennsylvania is it's a conservative wing is protecting our low tax status at the expense of our kids. And I hope that's what the court decision will point out. And obviously the lack of equity that Senate leaders and House leaders can deliver more money to their school districts without a tax increase just because they lose kids is increasingly becoming a conversation in the House and Senate floor and chambers. So there will be pressure. This year, the House and Senate leaders said they didn't want to do a tax increase because it's an election year. The entire House is up and a third of the Senate. While that is true, most of the House members and the Senate members do not have challengers. Not all, but most of them do not have hefty challengers, and they could have moved revenues this year. But they know that they're on a house of cards. I've been talking to House and Senate members this morning. I'm in Harrisburg. And they know that the revenue package that is being moved along with this budget is not going to even meet the raise enough revenue to support the expenditures that the House has already passed last night.
Oh, wow.
So they know they got to move something next year.
Kevin, you wanted to say something before?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, we're talking about these rural districts that have lost enrollment, and Donna is right to point out that these are not wealthy districts. And, you know, all districts have been facing very high challenges, especially based on rising pension costs. And, you know, it's just certainly the fact that those districts have their own challenges. But it is the case, too, that what this the way we've been funding education de facto has meant is that those districts have been able to go to their local taxpayers less and ask for less property tax increases, while the districts that have been gaining kids and gaining challenging kids have continually had to ask for more. So if you look at the curve, look at the graph of how enrollment has changed and how that compares to the percentage of your personal income that you pay towards local taxes, it absolutely correlates. So pretty much every time the state is not acknowledging these things, it's the localities that are making up the difference.
We have a tweet actually for you, Kevin. New Hope Solbury most certainly has numerous English language learning students. And obviously this is based on a formula. Hopefully people coming up with the formula know their student body.
I'm speaking relatively to the rest of the state.
I mean,
you know, and comparing it to
Reading,
the most distressed districts in the state. I'm sure that all districts have English language learners, but it's just comparative. Yeah.
Gotcha. Donna, go ahead.
But I love that New Hope survey sent that, because down here in the southeast across the five counties, the share of students that are poor and low income in every district is rising, and the share of kids who have languages other than English as their first language is rising. And as Kevin points out, these are the very districts that are raising their property taxes to meet the needs of these students to the extent that they can. That's another part of this sort of quiet revolution that's happening in Pennsylvania. So in Warren County, the number of kids is shrinking, and the number of kids who are ELL isn't changing. The number of poor kids isn't changing so much. They have plenty of poor kids, but they're not rising necessarily. And so they aren't tapping their local tax base as much. So there is, you know, widespread division in the state between those communities that are really having to step up locally to meet their needs of their kids, while these other communities are able to meet them just simply by declining enrollment. And this is going to become more and more pronounced. And those legislative leaders are going to either have to make a shift in existing money, which they are not going to want to do, or they're going to have to step up and put revenues on the table so that as more low-income kids and English language learner kids are enrolling in our Delco, Monco, Chester, and Bucks districts, they are not constantly turning to their local taxpayers to meet those needs.
Another tweet, this one says, state didn't count actual enrollment for 25 years. Hard to believe. And Kevin, this is what we were talking about earlier, which was, and perhaps Donna, you know this better than anybody, about how money, I guess, was either chasing students or not chasing students.
Well, I think the idea is that, you know, it's really difficult, especially for a small rural district, to you know, adapt year to year with small fluctuations in enrollment. So the idea is, like, you know, let's not penalize a small, you know, district out in, you know, some far western county for losing 50 kids that year. That would, you know, relatively devastate their budget. So let's protect them. I think there wasn't the state didn't anticipate that there would be such drastic population changes. And if you look at a map of how population has changed, you see a large segment of the western half of the state essentially showing up on the eastern half of the state. It's not, maybe that's not where they went, but if you just look at how it changed, the eastern half grew significantly while the western half went down significantly. And it just so happens, again, that most of the legislative leaders in the state represent western districts.
Interesting. Let me just...
You should know, Marty, one of the things that's really interesting about that tweet and what Kevin said, we had this hold harmless, like nobody will receive less even though they have fewer students. That is unique. Other states across the country have what's called a dynamic student count. They give out their money in relationship to the number of kids in the district. If you lose kids, you lose money. That's just the breaks of the game. Mm-hmm. Now, they have formulas that weight poor kids and ELL kids, and, you know, they're smart formulas, but they don't hold a district harmless for the loss of its children. And so we stand out in this regard. So that's why it is relatively unbelievable, because other states do not do this.
And that's Donna Cooper, head of Public Citizens for Children and Youth here in Pennsylvania, and Kevin McCrory with us as well, statewide education reporter for Keystone Crossroads. And you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Kevin, I know from some of superintendents that we've talked to is that with the old lack of formula, it was hard to do planning. It was hard to sort of figure out how you were going to budget for the next school year. Does this in any way address that? I'm also thinking of the kind of hangover from all the budget crisis of this particular fiscal year.
I think it does address that. I mean, now that you have a formula on the table that everyone is buying into, you know, you can predictably say, okay, if they raise $200 million and you look down the graph, you can say that if I'm Reading, this is how much I'm going to get. If I'm New Hope, this is how much I'm going to get. That definitely helps planning. I mean, the fact that the budget wasn't passed on time, that's still a source of major frustration for a lot of school boards. And I think there's...
Didn't they go have to borrow money?
Some had to borrow money. You know, some have to, you know, plan 2 years out, and it's impossible to plan 2 years out when you don't know what the legislators are going to do. So that continues, I think, to be a fear of, you know, in this divided government we have between the governor and the legislature, how often is this going to happen? You still have, you know, major concern among school boards and administrators in the borrowing. You know, we've been downgraded so many times that, you know, for instance, this Intercept program that basically the state guarantees the loans a district has to take out in case of an impasse or something like that. The ratings agencies have withdrawn their ratings. So you have some districts who are now looking in the market and the banks aren't willing to, lend to them. So I can't imagine what would happen this year if we went as long again, because I think it would be much harder for districts to borrow money. And the uncertainty is certainly there.
Don, I know this is something when you worked in the Rendell administration in Harrisburg, the question is, what is a cost to provide a really good education for children, for school children in Pennsylvania? And that was a while ago. Do we know what that number is today?
Well, actually not. During the Rendell days, we did a costing out study. Actually, the House Republicans were the leaders in demanding that we do a cost study to figure out how much it takes. And at that point, it found that on average, for the average student, not the poor ELL student, it was about $8,000 per student. And then there were factors that we had weights, much like Kevin talked about, in terms of how much you would have to spend to get to a quality education for a child who was poor or English language learner, and that took us up to about $11,000 a student for those kids. And that was a House study, and in fact, I think that study is as valid today as it was in 2006 when it was done. If you take that study and sort of shift to inflation, you're over at about $9,250 for the kid who's coming in without a lot of needs, and about $12,000 to $13,000 for the kid who's coming in with a lot of needs, and a little bit more even if they really don't speak English and they're living on $10,000 a year and they have maybe been in the foster care system. But just to put that in contrast, Marty, you know, Lower Merion is spending about $25,000.
Is that what it is?
So they have children who are coming to school from some of the most advantaged families in the state, and they know to get a quality education for those kids, they have to spend way more than the costing out study even projected. So in the preparation of this formula, because there was a formula in place after the costing out study for 4 years, and then when the Corbett administration came in, they blacklined that. They killed that formula. So a new formula has now been put in place, but it was done absent a costing out study because when you do a costing out study, you then sum up the amount of money that was needed. So in 2006, that study said we needed $3.2 billion to get the resources we needed for every school district in the state, and about 2.5 of that was at the state level and the rest at the local level. Again, if you inflate that to now, we need about, you know, $4 billion, of which about $3.2 needs to come out of the state to get us where we need to be.
Donna, I hate to do this. We're going to leave it there. I'm sure we'll be picking up on this very important issue in the coming months ahead. Thanks a lot, Donna Cooper and Kevin McCrory, for joining us on Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We were just talking about Pennsylvania's new funding formula. Well, let's cross the river to find out what New Jersey is doing about funding for education. Governor Christie has proposed a flat rate of $6,599 per pupil, which would require a change in the state constitution. Now, today, some poor districts get as much as $20,000 per student, while some well-off districts get a few thousand dollars per student from the state. Our guest, John Mooney, talked with the governor about what he calls his fairness formula. John Mooney is education reporter, founding editor, and CEO of NJ Spotlight. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. So what is Chris Christie's fairness formula? How would that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to listen to your previous guest talk about what's happening in Pennsylvania, because we're moving in the other direction. New Jersey has had a fairly complex formula, a very complex formula, for a decade or more that does steer additional aid to students or to schools that have students coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. And he basically wants to roll that back.
Right.
And we've had this very wide disparity on how much aid has gone to different districts. And he wants to move it all to, as you said, a set sum of $6,599 per student. In part to address some of the issues that have come up with our property taxes, that, you know, there's a big impetus in that. We have some of the highest property taxes in the country, and he thinks by doing that, that would allow some districts to reduce their property taxes as they get more aid, But obviously, you would have a huge impact on districts that get well more than that. And those are largely our urban districts, including across the river from you in Camden, where it could be literally 50-75% of their aid would be reduced.
In fact, you did an interview with the governor, and you kept asking him that question, which is how would a district like Newark or Camden, how would they make up the money that they currently get from the government?
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't make it up. I mean, they would have to raise their taxes to a degree, and there's only so much, you know, available in terms of their tax bases. But by and large, his you know, at least his vision is that they would slowly be downsizing. He sees they have lost a lot of students, and one of the things that hasn't happened in New Jersey as much, and it was referred to earlier in Pennsylvania, is we also have a hold harmless clause. So aid has not been reduced terribly for large urban districts that have lost kids. And so as these districts shrink, schools close, he said, you know, his point is they would be right-sizing or downsizing to what's an appropriate size.
But this would, and we'll get to whether it will make it through the legislature, but this would require amending the state constitution, is that right?
Yes. Without that, it certainly would be challenged in the courts, and you know, certainly given the track record of our state Supreme Court, wouldn't survive it. And to be honest with you, even if it moves even further along, it may get challenged in the courts. But, you know, this is a fundamental thing in our state constitution where we require or demand that the state provide a thorough and efficient education for all students, kindergarten through high school. And they have based many years of rulings on that. Our case is well known in these parts as Abbott versus Burke, and has been one of the more progressive school equity cases in the country. And, you know, this certainly flies in the face of that. And I think that's totally his intention. He is the governor has been long a critic of Abbott versus Burke, saying that too much money is going into urban schools and not enough to suburban. So I think that's the message he's trying to send. But certainly the courts would have some say on that.
Indeed. I mean, clearly you've got a governor who has had and perhaps still has national aspirations. Do you think there are some political calculations involved in this?
Oh, you think? Yeah, I would. I would say there's all political calculations involved in
gotcha.
This. I think this is at least as it currently stands, this is not going anywhere in the legislature. The Democrats have rebuked it right out of the gate, and to be honest with you, I haven't seen too many folks in the schools community embrace it. Republicans have by and large been sort of lined up on it, but it is not, there's no great groundswell, at least at the moment, that's going to give this much momentum. But he's sending a message, on several grounds. I mean, I think he is, as I said, he's long been a critic of Abbott, and I think this is, you know, a message he wants to send out that this is a better way. But, you know, I think it in some ways, and maybe it's too simple, it certainly reminds me of Donald Trump a little bit in terms of putting out some ideas that really, you know, don't make a whole lot of sense or aren't going anywhere. But the message is there. The headline's there. It certainly can be used as somewhat leverage on some of the other debates that we're going through in New Jersey, as we have a state budget that's now up for vote or up for his signature. There's a gas tax being debated as well. I mean, these all things play together, and I think he's sending a message that he's out there. He's going to be making noise the next year and a half, and he's, you know, not to be taken lightly.
Do you think he's sending a message to Donald Trump that perhaps he'd be a very good vice president?
Or education secretary,
for
that matter.
Or education secretary.
It's not a terribly, I mean, to be honest with you, the approach isn't a terribly surprising tack for him, you know, that he would come out with something this, you know, some have called it radical, certainly bold. I've even called it a little delusional. But it wasn't this specific idea was not one that he had been talking about before. I mean, at first he was trying to remake the court. He's been putting forward school funding that is largely kept to, you know, not to the formula, at least in spirit. He has been badly underfunding the formula, but he wasn't blowing it up. And then for him to come out with this, it comes at a time also where Senate President Steve Sweeney, the Democrat and a very likely candidate for governor next year, has put out his own proposal around school funding, which is far less far-reaching. He's called for a commission to take a look at some of the details and sort of fix around the edges. And that commission then would report back to the legislature, which would have a yay or nay vote, and it sort of has taken out the political horse trading that goes on many issues, including school funding. So this is also, I think, Chris Christie sort of sending a message that, Steve Sweeney, you're not going far enough in my eyes. And so I think these are all playing into it.
In fact, I think he called Sweeney's idea small.
Yes, too small for him, though he didn't rule it out, which sort of sent me, sent a signal that I think this is all part of that. But he's out there today. I think he's in Wall Township. This is the governor is in Wall Township trying to drum up support for it. And it's not, in some of these communities, and I'm guessing Wall Township, I haven't looked it up yet, but I'm guessing they get well less than 6,500, and that's why he's there. In some of these communities that are really hitting, some hard times with property taxes, this can be appealing. I think Steve Sweeney called it political red meat. I mean, it's politically not the dumbest idea, and it's certainly in keeping with his whole populist, at least image, the governor's populist image. But it's also, so unlikely to be getting much further than this. And whether this will continue to be a drumbeat for the next year or so, I'm not sure. But it certainly keeps us busy this summer.
Absolutely. And I'm assuming in New Jersey, like Pennsylvania, the property taxes largely go or maybe exclusively go to pay for schools?
Yeah, in large part. I think two-thirds of our tax bills, the average tax bill, goes to schools. And about statewide, about two-thirds of all school spending is paid through property taxes, the bulk of the rest of it coming from state funding. But in some districts, like Camden, like Newark and Trenton, it's 80, 90% comes from the state. While in some communities like Cherry Hill or some of the more well-to-do communities, it's well less than even 10%. So that sort of speaks to the wide disparities we have.
And are those disparities wide? I mean, even with the state trying to make up the difference, does that even out some of these disparities or do they still exist?
No, well, I mean, you're still going to have. I mean, what is interesting with this Abbott versus Burke case is that we now have our urban districts are predominantly among the highest spending in the state because we have these weighted formulas. And so you do have $25,000, even $30,000 a kid in some communities. And the governor has latched onto that. He's saying, look at, an Asbury Park or even a Camden, which is an ironic choice since the state now runs it. But, they're spending all this money and the kids aren't performing per se or at least up to, the state standards in terms of testing and the like. So in our case, we have very high spending in our urban districts. And it's, there is some valid questions. Is that money being spent well? Is it going to the places that can make the most difference? So it certainly would bring those totals down. Would it lift up the lower end, of the scale? I think, to be honest with you, there'd be a lot of pressure in those communities to reduce their property taxes first. So I'm not sure it's necessarily going to add to spending in those districts either. So to your question, I'm not sure it's necessarily going to close those gaps.
And that's John Mooney. He's education reporter, also founding editor and CEO of NJ Spotlight, talking about Governor Chris Christie's idea, a proposed flat rate of almost $7,000 per pupil being spent in New Jersey. Looks like there's a lot of pushback on that idea. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about education funding in New Jersey? John, you mentioned the fact that there's some talk about increasing the gas tax. And I have to say, as a Pennsylvania resident, I'm always happy when I have to drive over to New Jersey so I can get my cheap gas over there. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, I mean, we have a crisis looming, and that may be an understatement, where our transportation trust fund will be running out at the end of this month and basically leaving local communities virtually no money to fund new projects, road and bridge projects, other than federal funds that will continue. And I think everyone has acknowledged that that's an untenable situation. And how to fix it has been the back and forth that's been really dominating discussions in our state house for the last, you know, several months. And the Democrats have been pushing to raise the gas tax pretty significantly to up to, I think it's 37 cents a gallon, which would right now we're among the lowest, I think 14, and this would put us in the middle. Yes, it would make it less attractive for folks driving through New Jersey. I'm always sad to be leaving New Jersey
and having
to pay the higher the higher taxes. But this governor does not, as we well know, Governor Christie is not one to raise taxes. Certainly not without a fight. But he hasn't raised, you know, by and large, he hasn't raised any taxes in his 6.5 years. And so there's been a lot of back and forth. And the proposal that came out, and for a long time, the thought was that in exchange for a higher gas tax, the legislature would go along with reduced estate taxes and inheritance tax. And these were sort of the chips on the table. And then last night, somewhat out of the blue, I wasn't covering it, but our reporter was there. The governor came out with the assembly speaker, Vincent Prieto from Hudson County, also a Democrat, with a deal, at least on the assembly side, to reduce the sales tax instead of the estate tax and the inheritance tax, and reduce it from 7% to 6%. So that's the idea now on the table. The Senate has not gone along with this, and how that's going to play out is yet to be seen. But I will say that it does seem certain but it seems likely that the gas tax will be going up. So maybe you'll be visiting a little less, Marty. But
oh, never.
But
love your
but
beaches.
Of course, yes. But what the trade-off is going to be is still to be decided.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Just a slightly tangential couple of questions here, John. What is the how do people in New Jersey feel about their governor these days?
Well, and I don't think it's all that tangential, actually, in terms of what we're talking about. His approval ratings are record lows, at least the last I saw of him. They were down in the mid to high 20%. And this is for a governor who at his high was, you know, at 60 and or well in the 50s and won his second term by a landslide and obviously used all that to run for president, or at least to try to run for president. But now, you know, I think in part because of that, you know, his long stays outside of the state as he was running for the GOP nomination, the folks started souring on him, and we have a pension crisis that we haven't talked about, but that's also looming. I mean, there was a lot of problems going on in New Jersey, and they had a governor who was in Iowa and New Hampshire, and I think it was all downhill for him. And I think that's part of these proposals. I think he wants, I'm not saying necessarily to raise his approval ratings, because I'm not sure he, you know, is totally beholden to polls, though I think any politician who says they don't follow polls, chances are they follow them quite closely. But I think he wants to be relevant again. I think he wants to leave a stronger legacy than right now he's leaving. He's, you know, deeply unpopular, and he's trying to push some buttons that are going to, you know, put him back in better stead. He's not done.
Yeah.
This is not a politician who's going to, you know, ride off in the sunset. I think even once he leaves office in New Jersey, we're going to be hearing plenty more from Chris Christie.
And I'm assuming since July 1st is Friday, some frantic days in New Jersey getting a budget pulled together?
Yeah. I mean, they have at this point, the budget has been approved by, you know, and that's separate from the gas tax and the transportation. That was a separate bill that has been approved by the legislature. The governor is going to take a look at it, sure, to do some trimming. He always does. But they came back with a budget fairly close to his, a couple extras that they want, $25 million for expanded preschool and a few other things. But so there will be some back and forth. But yes, the week is not done yet.
John Mooney, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Education reporter and founding editor and CEO of NJ Spotlight. Rounding out our trio of guests in this hour of Radio Times, looking at education funding both in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.